is talking about this Buddha potential that we all have and how we can all become Buddhas. And how the Buddha mind is this omniscient mind, which knows everything, and is a mind, of course, of deep compassion. So the wisdom and the compassion together. And he said to us nuns, and he had tears in his eyes when he was saying this, he said, if only you knew, if only you could be aware all the time that the Buddhas only want to help you. They can't do anything else. So that's what's happening tonight. The Buddhas are helping us. And we've got quite a tricky topic here, much ado about nothing. If I'd known I was going to be teaching this, I would have read the play, but I can't refer back to the play, so we'll have to do without that. So first of all, we need to know what nothing is or is not. And this is going to make you think. Oh, I better not trip over. I've got that. There we are. Okay. Much ado about nothing. All right. Here's a nice, tricky phrase for you. Nothing is a non affirming negation. Well, you're all at university, you need some hard words, don't you? That's an A. So I'll put that up here because this is something we have to remember all the time when we're looking at emptiness, which we also call nothingness. And when we refer to that, we're not referring to anything, any object, anything existent. So that if I say there's an elephant in this room, I don't think there's one, is there? And you say, okay, Trudy, that's ridiculous. There's no elephant in this room. You're not an elephant, I hope. No, I don't think he's an elephant. You say, Trudy, there's no elephant in this room. But you're not proposing... If I thought this was an elephant, right? And I said, but that's the elephant. Then, you, of course, you'd say, no, that's not an elephant. And I might say, well, that statue over there is an elephant. And you say, no, that's not an elephant. So that when you say there's no elephant in this room, you're not proposing that there's going to be anything else in the place of the elephant. Is that much clear? Because this is very, very important. So when you're not asserting something else in its place, you're talking about a non-affirming negation. That just means I'm saying there's nothing else in its place. And this is one of the reasons why the study of emptiness is so incredibly difficult, because we keep on trying to think of things to put in the place of emptiness. So let me backtrack a bit to more ordinary experience and less intellectual game-playing with words. Well, it's not game-playing. It's a very, very important concept. But we use the words selflessness, emptiness. Both of these words are used for much the same thing. And it can refer to an object. I can say this cup exhibits emptiness, even though it still has plenty of tea in it, I can assure you, because I want to drink it. So we can say this cup is empty, but you say, well, look, there's still tea in it. But when you say there's tea in it, that's an affirming negation. There's something else in it. So let's say I've finished drinking up my tea and I now say this cup is empty. They say, oh yes, Churny, it's empty, but it's now got air in it. So the air is an affirming negation. Right. So what do we mean when we say the cup is empty or the cup is selfless? Now the word selflessness is also another way of referring both to objects and to people. But in the West, mostly when we talk about selflessness, we're talking about ourselves. And the two terms are much the same. They have slightly different connotations, but we don't need to worry about that at the moment. So these two words are the same. So when I say an object is empty, it is empty of something, but I'm not putting anything else in its place. I'll put this over here. We've got lots of colours, that's good. We'll go red. So what is it empty of? Now, it's empty of having a non-affirming negation in it. That's what it's empty of. But because a non-affirming negation is difficult to understand, we say it's empty of existing in a certain way. So the word selfless or the word emptiness is a shorthand way of saying everything is empty of, and the most subtle way of saying it, inherent existence. Right? So it does not have inherent existence. So what this means is that let me take the cup. One way of understanding this is to understand impermanence. Right? So I'm not talking about the conventional emptiness of the cup, because it's still got my cup of tea in it. But this cup is empty of lasting forever and ever without change. True? If you imagine another couple of thousand years' time, it will have totally disintegrated. Certainly a cup of tea will be gone. I'll make sure of that. Although the cup itself might last a bit longer. So we know that it is not permanent. And that really means it does not change. Moment to moment. So that's one way of looking at it. So when I say this cup is empty, it is empty of having an existence which does not change from moment to moment, which is quite evident, even though it might look pretty much the same cup by the time I finish my cup of tea. Then there will have been movement in the molecules inside the cup at that subtle, more subtle level. And there'll be some stains, perhaps, from the tea if I take long enough time to drink it. So to say that it does not change is one way of saying it doesn't exist inherently. And we can also say it does not exist from its own side. Or by its own characteristics. Now, what does this mean? Say it exists from its own side means that this came about without any external input. There was no one who collected the materials for making the cup. There was no one who got the machinery together to put the cup into this particular form. There was no one who made the cup of tea, which is currently inside the cup, so on and so forth. It came from its own side. It was just there. But we know that's ridiculous, don't we? And to say it's not there by virtue just of its characteristics. And this is a bit more subtle and a bit harder to understand. We know it's not there from its own side, and it looks as though it's there from its own characteristics because it feels solid enough and it's got the capable to hold things. But it didn't come about through those. It came, we caught a cup and something suitable to put tea in. We have labelled it as that. So it hasn't come from its own side. It hasn't come from its own characteristics. It's not permanent. It does not inherently exist. So when I say emptiness is a non-affirming negation, I'm saying that there is nothing else which exists in this cup other than the fact that it is first of all a dependent arising, let's put these are the two truths. And the two exist together. So this is one, it doesn't matter which one, and emptiness itself. Oh, I get very messy these days. So that's one. Two, it doesn't matter which way around you have them. So these are the two truths. You know the four truths, the four noble truths. I'm sure you've had teachings on them. When we talk about the two truths, we're talking about dependent arising and emptiness, or nothingness, or selflessness, whichever term you like to use. And the point about these is that one cannot exist without the other. So you take my cup again. I'll have another drink while I do that. So it's definitely impermanent because the water level's going down. So this cup, we know, came about through causes and effects. And we can enumerate all the different causes and effects which have has brought this cup into this room today and put it in my hands right now. There'd be hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of different causes and effects which led up to this particular cup at this particular moment. So that is the dependent arising side. This is the conventional truth. Okay? Now, at a conventional level, if we're practicing, say, scientific method correctly, then we're creating conventional truths. If I use logic correctly and reasoning, I'm creating a conventional truth. So that you may not be able to see, in fact you can't see how much tea is in there, but you can be pretty certain that there is tea in there, simply because of the way I treat the cup, right? So that is a logical step that you have made, which in this case is a valid step, and therefore it's valid. It's not untrue. When we talk about emptiness, we're saying something else. We're saying it is also untrue that this cup exists from its own side, independently, without being labelled, without any cause and effect. This cup is there. And that's what's not true. Now, there's one way of understanding the relationship between the two. And this is a metaphor, so please don't take it as being an exactly precise description. So again, if we take the cup, and if I could put the cup down just there, then I've used up that little bit of space. Right? And I might be able to put this on top of it because there's space for that, but I can't do it this way, unless I've got a very good sense of balance, because the space is really not there. Or having put my book there, that I can't, at that stage, I won't put the cup on top of it because it's a Dharma book, but I can't put the cup down on the cloth of the table, can I? because that space is already occupied. So the space which is not occupied, you can think of that space as being the area in which objects can move around. External space, dimensionality, if you like. And if there's not another object in a particular point of space, then we can put an object there, or we can move it into a different point. And if I tried to sit on one of your chairs, you'd find it very uncomfortable because you're already occupying the chair. Right? So I can't sit there. So space, in this metaphor, is like emptiness. And dependent arising is like moving the objects around within that space. So if I move an object from here over to here, I'm not necessarily putting it in there. So this space is now empty and there's nothing else in there. So in this way we have dependent arising and emptiness. Conventional truth, dependent arising, ultimate truth, the emptiness of inherent existence. These two necessarily go together. Now, there's one other point I would like to make. If you've got any questions now, write them down, because I'm about to change the subject a little bit. And I don't want you to forget the question. What can I rub off? Lunchtime meditation, Chinese group, I suppose they want... What's that?
The fire.
I like that. We can rub that off. We can rub the tens and tune in the much ado about nothing off. I don't want to know about that. Then I've got a bit small space. Okay, so if you've got your questions in your mind, if you need them answered. Because there's one other thing I want to talk about which confuses a lot of people, and that is, how can there possibly be no self? How can you exist without a self? And because I trained in psychotherapy, and one of the things that we do in psychotherapy is to strengthen, give confidence to a sense of self. And then as a Buddhist, I say, well, there's no self. And people say, you're totally crazy. I said, no, we need to understand the difference between conventional truth and which is the dependent arising, and ultimate truth, which is the emptiness. So we start here. Put self on that side and non-self on that side. No self, which is also emptiness, right? Now, and this side is the dependent arising side. That side is the ultimate truth. I can't reach up quite high enough to put that up there. So on the dependent arising side, we have a self, which is composed of the five aggregates, meaning it's composed of body and mind. And this self of mine is obviously different to each one of you. I'm not studying here at University of New South Wales. I'm a grandmother, and various things about being a grandmother, which you wouldn't want to have to bother about. And there's various things about you being a student. I've had enough of that sort of thing. I've done my thing. So we can conventionally say, here stands Venerable Tenzin Chuni. No? And she came about through the union of the egg and the sperm of her mum and dad, which is where her body aggregates came from, body aggregate, and her mind entered into that, and that's where her mental aggregates came from. And we put them together, feed them, let them grow up, give her a bit of learning, and then you have Tenzin Chuni here. Well, that's not your story. So this conventional self can be valid. Right? We can have a valid conventional self Or it can be not valid. Okay. So what would I mean? If I tried to tell you that I'm not a Buddhist nun and I'm 21 years old and I always wear pink. Well, I've got pink shoes on, so... anything other than robes. I always wear lay clothes, right? You'd say, that's not true. That's not a valid description of who you are. It's a non-valid one. And if I say, for example, that I can't play the piano, now you don't know whether that's valid or not. I know whether it's valid or not. You don't know. It is valid. I can, but not very well. If I say, I never get upset. If I see myself as a person who never gets upset, because after all, I am a Buddhist nun. Buddhist nuns don't get upset, do they? Then you could very easily say, and certainly my children and grandchildren say, Nanny, that is not right. You do get upset. Right? So this view of myself as a person who doesn't get upset is not a valid view. But it's a view of my conventional self that does not get upset. So this is what psychology does. Get another colour. Psychology and psychotherapy are working between these two. So when somebody came to see me in the days when I worked as a psychotherapist, then their understanding of themselves was out of kilter one way or another. They wanted that straightened out. They wanted me to help to get from there up to there. And that's the role of psychotherapy, it's the role of counselling, it's the role of behavioural cognitive therapy, or you know, whichever of the therapies you want to add in. So that's the reign of psychotherapy. But what the Buddha was doing when he talked about selflessness, he was talking about this relationship. So here is the Buddha's teachings. And he was saying that our suffering comes from the fact that we don't know that this conventional self, which is valid in the conventional way, is still not valid from the point of view of ultimate truth. Because we're still thinking of it as being existing, that there's something in us which exists regardless of how many lifetimes we've had, regardless of anything else. There's something about me which is me. Right? He said that's wrong. And that's the basis of Buddhism. That's where the Four Noble Truths come from. First, there is suffering. Secondly, there is a cause from suffering, which is karma, which comes from ignorance. Thirdly, there is cessation of suffering, which is important because in those days in India, there were people who believed that suffering was just there and you couldn't get rid of it. And there is a way to get rid of that suffering. So here is this refers to the root ignorance. Oops, it's not working so well. Whereas this one is referring to conventional ignorance. Himself knew the difference between these, because when the woman came to him dreadfully upset because her baby had died, and I know how upset I would have been if this had happened to one of my own children, and he said, go and collect a mustard seed from every family that has not experienced death. So she goes around thinking she's going to get a lot, and of course she doesn't come back with any. And then she realizes that her experience is common to everybody. Now, that's a little bit of behavioral cognitive therapy 2,500 years ago. The Buddha didn't say, you don't exist, your baby never existed, so there's nothing to worry about. Because that was not appropriate for that mother at that time. What she needed to know was that death is an inevitable part of life. If we are born, we are going to die. So what is the major cause of death? Not cancer, not heart disease, it's birth. So there we are. Here we're looking at what's valid and not valid between the conventional self and between the not valid conventional self and the conventional self, which is the role of psychotherapy and a lot of the Buddhist teachings on thought transformation, more basic teachings. And then when we start looking at the root ignorance, that's when we're looking at a different way of viewing reality and what that's about. And just to finish off that little graph, from the root ignorance, we get attachment. And we get craving. And we get the 12 links of dependent arising. And all that sort of stuff is all the way what happens from this point of root ignorance as it's impacting on the conventional self and turning what was a valid conventional self into an invalid one. So the valid conventional self is empty but doesn't necessarily know it's empty. That's the way we differentiate them. So this is the point where I stop talking and you can ask questions. And don't be like my son, who, after I became a Buddhist nun, he said, "What's all this emptiness stuff about, Mum?" So he still asks me every now and again. Now, surely you have some questions. And it's okay to ask them. Go on. Got one? Yes.
I've heard of the idea that, like, things that exist are some accretion of matter, which is just another form of energy.
Yes.
And that if all things are energy, then there's no real one state, and that we're all just kind of in this mixing pot of different states of knowing things as organic beings. And it doesn't really appeal to me as an idea, because it means that what I'm experiencing isn't something that's... it's all just kind of like fun and games. It's not necessarily something of meaning or importance. It's just another movement of the wave, another tide, or that sort of idea. So is Buddhism teaching kind of this middle way of embracing the importance of having a state at all with this idea of there's not really any objective state, it's all just one thing? Is this the...
Yeah, well, you're talking about E=mc², aren't you? Yeah. Energy and matter are interchangeable, and therefore... Even though we talk about the mind then is representative of some form of energy. And the current general attitude in Western science is that the mind is an epiphenomenon of the brain. In other words, it's just we label all this activity of the brain as mind. It's not something which exists independently. Not everybody agrees with that. And one of the principal writers in that area is Alan Wallace. Look him up on the internet. He's been writing for a long time. It's actually B. Alan Wallace. I hope you can read this writing of mine. He's trained in Tibetan Buddhism. He trained as a monk. He also did a physics degree before he became a Buddhist, so he knows what he's talking about when he's talking about quantum mechanics and things like that. And he talks a lot about the need to have more respect for what he calls contemplative science, where the ways in which you are investigating your own mind can be identified as being valid, and therefore the outcome is a valid outcome. And on that base, Alan Wallace would argue that what we see from the lamas doesn't fit in with what we know about the mind in Western psychology. There are other things which are happening. And these days, I just assume the lamas are clairvoyant for that reason, because I've experienced it so many times. And remember, I've got a science degree, and I grew up as a sceptic, so I'm not going to fall into that one very easily. But it has been demonstrated to me on a number of occasions that this particular lama was definitely had some sort of awareness of my mind. And the lama may not have been present with me even. So because I've had those sorts of experiences, then I don't question it. And other people who've had that sort of experiences don't question it. So if you haven't had that sort of experience, then you're like a person who's colourblind, saying, well, there's really only two colours. There's no others. And I can say, well, look, it's just because there's something wrong with your eye sense consciousness. And there is. And you say, well, I can't experience it. I can't observe it. So therefore it doesn't exist. So it comes into that basis. We can't definitively prove one way or another your point of view or the Buddha's point of view. But what happens? You see, this teaching on emptiness has a profound impact on ethics and values, on the development of wisdom and compassion. There's not much science that does that. Science, other than the values which are there within the scientific method, science itself doesn't look at things. But the point of understanding all this is that we begin to understand the root ignorance, which that we exist. Now, this root ignorance we can also call self-grasping. We're grasping at something which we think exists. Buddha said, no. Self-cherishing, in the Buddhist sense, is really selfishness. We can understand selfishness. That arises out of this feeling that there's something here that we have to protect. And if there's something we have to protect, then we become attached to the things that we want to protect on our own behalf, and we have a aversion to experiences that we don't want ourselves to have anything to do with. And then you get all the other negative emotions arise out of that. So by looking at it this way, it's not just a philosophy, it's also a teaching on the basics of ethics at its most profound. So it's saying much more than ethics is about, you know, don't harm other people. Although, obviously, Buddhism says that. Many people would say that. But when you say, well, why should I not harm them? Well, everybody's happier. I know the answers that they give. But in Buddhism, you get back down into the root of all that and say, well, because that exists, then all my other negative emotions arise from that. So I write a blog every 3 months, which is published by Mandala Magazine, which is our in-house magazine. And in one of those blogs I said, Merlin is a horse. Merlin is actually my dog. One of these, any of you have read the Harry McCleary stories when you were little? Lots of Aussie children know this one, but he's just like Harry McCleary. He's very scruffy and gets into trouble. So in this one, I label my dog as a horse. And as the story goes, I keep feeding him chaff, which of course he won't eat. I try and put a saddle on his back, which doesn't fit. And So it goes on and on like this. So the outcome of how we label things is also determines on how we react to those things. So if I really believe Merlin was a horse, which is a bit hard to actually believe, but if I was psychotic for some reason and I kept on feeding him these things, then clearly the dog would suffer because of my ignorance about the true nature of this animal's reality. It's a dog reality, not a horse reality. So all these things start to fall into place. You have a union of the ethical and value system, which is so important when we relate to each other, which arises out of the teaching on ignorance. So it's not just a philosophical statement. It's more important than that. Yeah.
I didn't quite understand before. I was hoping you could re-elaborate on why if something isn't permanent, it does not change.
Oh, that's the definition of permanence within the Abhidharma. So that if you look up an English dictionary, permanence does not mean that. But in the Buddhist teachings, when the word whatever the Sanskrit word is, I don't know, but when it's translated as permanent, it means this thing does not change. So this is also quite important when Buddhists are having conversations with Christians, and Christians will say we have a permanent soul because it lasts forever. And if I say to them, well, do you think that soul never changes? Well, of course it changes. It goes to heaven and it becomes more deeply affected by its relationship with God. So it's quite happy to say it changes. So from the Buddhist point of view, if we think that they're talking about something non-changing because they've used the word permanent, then there's a mismatch between what we're talking about as Buddhists and what Christians are talking about. So that's why I put down permanent means it does not change, to make that clear. That is the definition of permanence within the Buddhist teachings. So I'm afraid you're just stuck with that, like physics can take an ordinary term and give it some sort of special connotation. Well, try this out. Since I've just said you don't exist in the way that you think you exist, what implication does that have for you as a student here at the university? Does it make a difference or does it not? Now you can turn around and talk to each other for a little while. So that I'm not doing all the talking. Groups of three or four, just swing the chairs around. I used to be a teacher as well. What are the implications of this? You don't exist the way you think you exist. How does that affect you as a student? I think it's a good thing.
I'm just making it.
Did we have any profound insights? Well, you've all been talking, so you must be talking about something. Why? I'll look you in the eyes. Right. Okay. What were you doing about in the street? Just one foot.
To change our perspective and not focus that much on I.
Mm-hmm. Okay, what about this group? Just one foot. Whisper it to me and then I'll say it out loud.
What did he talk?
Well, I'll come back.
We were saying a similar thing to the first group, that there's no need to put, like when you put the label of student on something, that creates certain expectations as to, this other sense of happiness or sadness, like success, achievement. Then there's like needs that you have to fulfill to be a student and other labels that come with, like, whether or not you're doing well at life or whether you're failing. So removing the label of student and leaving yourself in a space of just being, then you don't necessarily have to, fall prey to that cycle of unhappiness, generating your own sort of unhappiness in these labels.
This huge flexibility arises, isn't it? What about this group?
We were just saying that it's like we're playing the role of being a student. So essentially, we're talking the same thing at the other group as well. So it's just a role. You know, suddenly you get a job, you don't get the job, that's fine. But don't attach to it.
Yeah. What about you?
I guess it's something like, where do we draw the lines between conventional and ultimate truth?
Yeah.
Where the lines are drawn, because both are sort of dependent on our perceptions. I mean, when our methods of coming to the conventional and ultimate truth are depend dependent on our perceptions and how we experience our lives.
Yes, at this stage it is. But if you follow through the teachings, and particularly following through the great Indian teachers like Karma Vishnu, and his stages of meditation, then you start to see the development that goes through to having an experiential understanding of what emptiness is about instead of just talking about it through our heads. Because you can pretty well understand the logic here. Might be difficult at first, but it's not that hard to understand. But to realise this so that it affects our behaviour every second of the day is a different matter altogether. So in order to achieve that, of course, we've got to study the whole of the Dharma, not just what emptiness is about. And when we study emptiness, we start to get some view of what it is that we're actually trying to move towards in the process of studying. Now, what happened up with this lot? I should get two sentences from you because you're such a big group.
Well, when Murray was there, this question is for students. I'm not a student. So there's a label there that I say, okay, you students can answer. So that's how we draw ourselves, like, as a label.
That's right.
That I'm not a student, so students should answer the question.
So what are you?
I don't know.
That's probably the best answer. Okay. Well, we know you're a girl for a start. So we all have these labels. So that helps us to see these labels. It helps us to understand that we have a lot of flexibility. Now, what time am I actually supposed to finish? That clock's slow, according to my... According to this, we're now up at... Oh, it's gone off again. It's now...
Right,
yeah, 20 past 8. Is that right? Finish at 8:30?
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. I have a question. Do you think that, or does Buddha say, I don't know, do you think that it's like in relation with other non-selves that we can actually have these like glimpses of experiencing that non-self kind of state where you know, like you have that experience with someone and you're not thinking about all these things that make you a valid
yeah, so you're just in that experience. Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
So you're not aware of yourself.
Yeah, like do you think everybody actually has like even just glimpses of that experience without
knowing it? That's a tiny metaphor for it, but it's not the actual experience of emptiness.
Okay.
But it because it's also such a nice experience to be in, a very creative state, then it gives us the encouragement to find out what more of this emptiness is about. Because in the process of developing our meditation skills and developing our sense of ethics and making changes there, then we develop what's called bliss and pliancy in the body, a great deal of flexibility, which feels good. So I don't think Buddhism is about feeling bad. You're allowed to feel good. That answer your question?
Yeah.
Good. Yes?
I just want to ask, what makes the mind... So you say all aggregates of something, but why, like, for example, a cup does not have a mind, but we do have a mind.
Good. Well, according to the teachings again, mind and matter are two separate entities, if you like. That mind, in one lifetime, mind uses matter, as it were, to make things happen. That's the best way I can describe it, I suppose. So from the Buddha's point of view, the mind is the principal thing. And of the five aggregates, four of them are mental aggregates, and only one aggregate is the body, which I find interesting in itself. So that at the moment of conception, the mind has come from the bardo state, from the intermediate state between one life and the next. and that enters the fertilized egg. So that the mind is not, does not come into the egg in the same way that the genetic structure comes into the fertilized egg. We know about the genes and how the genes split up and then come to... doesn't come in that way. There's no mind that anybody can see or measure at that particular point. So this is what is taught, but we can't, as I say, we can't definitively prove it. So what do? We have to take one statement or the other statement. If we take the statement that mind is just something which is just energy emanating from matter, and matter is the most important thing, then we actually have no free will. Because everything that happens to us is predetermined by physical things that have happened before. If you feel that you have free will and that you are able to make choices, and you can choose whether to study or not, you can choose whether to be kind or not, many things we feel we choose. If you feel that you have a sense of choice, then you're actually coming from the point, the philosophical point, that the mind is separate from matter. Because from the materialistic point of view, you can't actually do that. You only think you do it. So these are very basic philosophical questions that we have to investigate. And the Buddha's position on it was quite clear. He said they're two separate entities. The mind comes in from a different source to the egg and the sperm, which are about to be fertilised, and they come from previous lifetimes. And as you know, it carries the karma seeds and imprints into that next life. And so you get children who are maybe geniuses at playing the piano at the age of 3 or things like that. So, is that a sufficient answer? Or not? I can't quite remember what the question originally was.
Yeah.
More things to think about. Yes?
I want to ask, like, when someone have come enlightened, where is the mind go when that person is entered nirvana? Still there.
When we become enlightened, we don't suddenly disappear in a burst of love, which you might do in a movie, go to some other space. That's not what happens. If I became enlightened right at the moment, you wouldn't notice any difference. Probably. You might notice a difference in the sense of my deepening compassion or my deepening awareness of what you guys are up to. But I'd still be tense and churning, and I'd still have my pink sneakers on and things like this. So what happens? What happens is when we realise enlightenment, we fully and experientially realise that we have been led up the garden path for countless lifetimes and we didn't have to believe it. It's like that. So if I'm trying to look for the Vegemite in the supermarket, and if you've ever been in the supermarket, you go up and down the aisles looking for something and you can't see it, and somebody says, oh, it's in aisle 3. And they say, but I've been in aisle 3. You go back to aisle 3. That's exactly where it was. You didn't see it at first. Ah, now I've got it. So enlightenment is that, more that sort of experience. Ah, now I've got it. But because it's been happening at such a deep level, it then completely changes the way we see the world. So before, with the Vegemite example, we couldn't see any Vegemite in aisle 3. Somebody says, yes, it is definitely there in aisle 3, therefore I will go down, I'll trust this person, go down. There it is in aisle 3. Irrefutable evidence. And so your attitude towards aisle 3 has now changed. Where before it didn't have Vegemite, now it does. You haven't changed. So here we are, we see through this myth. Absolutely, completely. And having seen through it, then we are irrevocably changed from that point onwards. Because we see it as a truth. We know it is a truth. If I asked you, durian fruit's a good one. I went to Malaysia, I'd never tasted durian fruit, and people said, oh, it's like this or it's like that. So the people I was staying with said, well, you've got to taste it. So first they gave me some cake, which had the flavour in it. That was all right. It was quite nice. And then they gave me something that was a bit like yogurt with some durian flavour. That was okay. So then they tried me out with the proper fruit. And the other two, of course, you didn't get the smell. Now, people had tried to explain to me what it was like to eat this fruit. And when I opened it up and I smelt the smell, I thought, oh, my God, that's what everybody talks about. And I said, well, this is a good test of expectations. So normally if I smelt a smell like that, it would be something horrible to cane. But people say this is good fruit, therefore I will trust it and taste it, which I did. Loved it. Right, so it's like that. You don't know what this is going to be like. But somebody that you trust says, all right, you might have a few problems on the way, but once you taste it, you'll know exactly what it's like. In other words, we cannot... things that we experience from our senses, we cannot fully describe to another person. It's an interesting thing in itself. So this is an experiential thing. So I want to close... Oh, shut my book. That was silly. With a quote in this book, which I just happen to have in my bag. It's called Advice from a Spiritual Friend. And Geshe Rabtun and Geshe Dagi were two of the first of the Tibetan lamas to teach in the West. And this is where they're talking about the emptiness of the mind. So I want you to actually listen to this in a sort of like a meditation rather than me being a teacher reading something out. So I want you to sit in that meditation posture so you absorb the information in that way. And then when I've finished that, then we'll finish. Although it is difficult to realize emptiness, it is possible. By meditating on our own being and on outer phenomena, to recognize the invalidity of our ignorant concept of self-existence. So we can recognize that, but, they say, a further complication remains because our conception of independent existence also applies very powerfully to the mind that is meditating. So your mind, which is listening at the moment, feels, assumes it is inherently existent. When such a difficulty arises, we must concentrate on consciousness itself in order to perceive that the mind too is empty and does not exist independently. The mind has not come from somewhere like a guest who has come into a room, nor does it go to anywhere. It has no form or colour, does not abide in any definite place. In fact, it is completely intangible, meaning out of the range of any of our senses, and depends on only two things, the object which is perceived and the senses through which that object is perceived. Through constant observation of the mind in this way, we shall see that it does not exist in the way we previously conceived it to. When we had thought that our mind was meditating, it always seemed as though we could hold on to and isolate this concept. But after meditating as described, we shall recognize the emptiness of this previous ignorant conception. However, this emptiness does not imply that the mind does not exist, but rather that there is no mind that can be grasped and isolated. since it does exist, we are able to use it for meditation. Now I'll go through that couple of sentences again. This emptiness does not imply that the mind does not exist, but rather that there is no mind that can be grasped and isolated. Since it does exist, we are able to use it for meditation. So a mind that cannot be grasped or isolated means that it cannot be measured by scientific instruments of any sort. Not directly. So what we do is we continue to study this concept of the mind not existing inherently, but that it does exist as a dependent arising or conventional. That if it did exist inherently, then it would never change and it could not be a dependent arising. If the mind is a dependent arising, then necessarily that can only happen if it is not permanent, not subject to change. In other words, if it is not inherently existent. So the conventional truth of dependent arising are only possible because the ultimate truth of emptiness is also true. Two things together, one cannot exist without the other. This means if we meditate on emptiness and we begin to feel that there is nothing there, then we have gone into the one fault of thinking that nothing exists. And if we counterbalance that by thinking, well, there's dependent arising and that is real and therefore it does exist from its own side, then we've gone into the materialist view. The middle way, which is what is meant by Buddhism as the middle path, is neither of those, but is able to see that dependent arising and lack of inherent existence, emptiness, are two ways of talking about the same reality. See if I can get a better ding. There we are. So thank you, everybody. I hope you enjoyed that session. I always enjoy teaching. And, yeah.